This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks.
Whenever you are gone, I just want to be with you. Please don't get me wrong, I just want to see a picture. Take a dirty picture for me, take a dirty picture. Take a dirty picture for me, take a dirty picture.
Whenever you are gone, I just want to be with you.
So that's Kesha and Tayo Cruz in their recent song, Dirty Picture. And the reason why we're playing it is, well, Anthony, actually, we're both parents, right?
That's right.
And did you see that article in the New York Times over the weekend, the one about sexting?
I did.
And what struck you most about it?
A lot. We should explain first for the people who didn't read it. The Times profiled this case in Washington State where a teenage girl, 14 years old, took a cell phone picture of herself in the nude, texted it to a boy she was interested in.
Yeah, and here's one of the things that got me about this story. They were in middle school, and the boy who received the sext, he was completely nonchalant about it, at least in the beginning. He said it was totally common that teens who are about to date frequently tell each other, oh, I really like you, and blah, 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 like, can you send me a picture?
But in this case, it turned into a really big deal, because when that young man forwarded the picture to another girl, she then flipped open her phone and sent the naked picture of that first girl to everyone in her phone book.
It was a totally mean girl's thing to do. And the girl who forwarded the sext to everyone, she even added the words "ho alert" to the text. So very cruel. But she admits she wasn't thinking about the consequences at the time when she did it. But the fact is that within 24 hours, hundreds of teens had the picture. And not only at that school, that particular middle school, but also at a district next door.
And at least one parent complained, or several at least. When the police eventually got involved, they arrested three kids, including the boy who forwarded the photo and the girl who re-forwarded.
Because they were arrested for spreading child pornography.
Right. And the whole district was in crisis mode. And it's had a profound effect on many lives, especially that of the girl who sent the picture in the first place.
So that's the story that appeared in the New York Times over the weekend. So, Anthony, what about it did strike you the most?
Well, it made me wonder just how common is this? I mean, technology makes so-called sexting so easy. And how do you control it? And I guess...
Well, let me guess, because okay. I bet it's the same thing that I was wondering.
Okay.
So what should parents do about it?
Exactly.
Well, that is our talker today, because we're pretty sure that sexting doesn't just happen in an extreme case out in Washington State. I'd bet it goes on right here. So as Anthony and I are wondering, what should parents do about it? And teens, what do you do about it? If you send racy pictures, why do you do it? I mean, does everybody? And do you worry about the consequences? And for everybody who's listening, everyone who's ever sent or received a sext or a parent of a teen, what is the real problem here? Is it technology, culture, or just modern parenting? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And, of course, since we are talking about technology, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Joining us now is Dana Boyd. She's a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Dana Boyd, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So the story that Anthony and I saw over the weekend, the one we just related, is about a young girl in Washington State. Her name, her first name was given. Her name's Marguerite. It seems very extreme, but how common is the sexting phenomenon?
It's much more common than you'd think. So Pew Internet and American Life Project did a national survey trying to actually measure that and found that 4% of teenagers ages 12 to 17 in the United States had sent or received a text of this image.
And in this case, if I read it correctly, it's not just a racy picture. This was either semi-nude or
so
fully nude.
Correct. And it's much more frequent when you talk about older teens. So the older teens, it's more like 8%. It ends up happening across schools of all over the country. So it's not even just specific schools or separate spaces. It ends up happening pervasively. What's even more interesting is that adults are actually just as common or just as likely to send these images as teenagers, if not more likely to do so.
Except when adults do it, it's legal.
Correct. And that's where the whole thing turns into a complete mess. Right? When young people send or receive these images, you're talking about the production and dissemination of child pornography, at least the possibility of such. It doesn't mean it necessarily will be prosecuted as such, but there's the possibility. And that's where everybody gets very concerned. And of course, there's the other question about sexuality. What does it mean that these young people are actually engaging in sexual awareness.
Well, let's actually talk a little bit about that, because that's one of the things that really sort of caught me. I have to admit, it caught me off guard. It makes me sound like I'm 100 years old. When we read about in the Times the attitude about the kids when they were sending these things back and forth, they didn't even think that it was a big deal. I mean, is sending racy pictures of your naked body when you're 12 no longer an issue?
We're seeing it everywhere within society. You see it in the movies. You see it as celebrities. This is how you think through sexuality. And so you have these young people who are sitting here going, well, it's not sex. It's not the same as, you know, is intercourse. They're sitting here saying, why is this worse? And so it's a way for them in many ways to come to terms with their sexuality, to flirt, to sort of joke around. And when it's in controlled relationships, it means one thing. For example, you know, even in this case, when they were dating, it signals one thing. And then this image starts to have a whole new life when it gets spread around. And that's when it turns from being something that's a part of sexuality to something that's about shaming.
Well, let's talk about a little bit more about how teenage culture and life, you know, whether we like it or not, is completely steeped in this sexualized imagery, because mm-hmm. the Times article referred to a fact that a Motorola ad during the Super Bowl, when, you know, possibly more Americans watch TV than ever at any other time, featured, you know, a young woman in a bubble bath taking a picture of herself with her phone saying, hey, I wonder if everyone's going to see this. And then it cuts to another image of, you know, men sort of leering at the picture. Motorola using it.
Right. And we're not only seeing it in that kind of messaging, we're seeing it from kids are seeing it with their parents. I talk to teenagers who open up their parents' phone and are like, oh, gross, right, and throwing it away, right? Yeah. So they're seeing it at multiple levels of imagery, both in terms of the mainstream news production, they're seeing it with the celebs, they're seeing it in the music. And so there's not a clear delineation of why it's more problematic for them to do it when everybody else around them is doing it.
Well, the other thing that I found really interesting is that the normalization of all this. The teens, you know, I'm going to give them credit because they are actually quite a bit more thoughtful than maybe we, you know, we say just in offhand, because they did this Q&A that I'm just looking at here in the New York Times as well with a group of teens, like a little focus group. And one teen said, actually, sexting to each other is a form of safe sex. You know, like it's actually a safer way to communicate romantic feelings than, you know, actually having sex. So they're thinking about it on those terms, too.
Right. And they're thinking about both the gains that they might achieve, right? The idea of actually connecting with somebody. But there's also consequences. The consequences for intercourse are the possibility of pregnancy or the possibility of STDs. The consequences for sexting are actually a lot more about shame and embarrassment. And so even when teens are thinking through the possible gains and thinking about the possibilities of really connecting to somebody, they're not always thinking through the consequences.
So you are from the Berkman Center, so let's talk about technology here.
Sure.
For a second. And then we've got a ton of callers, so I absolutely want to get to them. How much of the problem is technology, that it is so effortless? Like, you know, the girl who sent it to all the people in her phone book, you literally press a button even before you have time to process any thought about what might happen. That thing is out there, and it's out there forever.
So the practices predate the technology, right? The idea of taking photographs of yourself actually very much predates the technology. Polaroids were used for this long before. What's happened has to do with the scale of visibility. So the moment that you take these pictures, you can actually scale the visibility both to the peer group writ large and to the possibility of adults getting access to this. And that's what the technology really does, is it just magnifies these things. And so in many cases, adults didn't know that young people were taking photographs of themselves until you start to see them in this way.
Adults also are sort of behind their teens in terms of use and fluidity with the technology.
Some ways, yes, and some ways, no. I mean, the fact that adults are doing this all over the place should give us a big indicator that this is not just a teen practice. Adults are quite comfortable taking photos with their camera phones at this point. Whether they want to take them naked or not is a different matter.
Okay, let me push back on you just one point, just a little bit. Because I was talking about this with the producers earlier today. I may be dating myself a little bit here. But, you know, when I was in middle school, we had a phone. I definitely did not have a cell phone. I did not have a phone in my bedroom. The phone was in the kitchen. So even if I wanted to have, like, a racy conversation, for example, I couldn't, because it was in a public space. It was in my house. My parents were probably there, or my brother would overhear me or whatever. So the impulsive actions that we can forgive most teens for, were mediated by the fact that, you know, it wasn't so instantaneous. So, you know, isn't technology part of what's leading to maybe exacerbating a hypersexualized culture?
So technology changes the speed in both directions, right? On one hand, it allows for an impulsive action to have radical scaling and visibility really fast. On the other hand, it allows you to sit back and think quietly and thoughtfully. So, for example, I'll interview teenagers who will sit there and take 45 minutes to craft the perfect message as a flirt. Right, and make it look like it was written just off the cuff, right, with spelling mistakes and all of these things that was really thoughtfully written. So you have these moments about when does it go faster because of technology and when does it go slower. And teenagers will tell me it's a lot safer and more comfortable to write the perfect message then to approach somebody that they're attracted to in person, because that's far too scary because it's real time. So there's these different layers where some things are much faster. Scale is certainly much faster. But there's also the ability to slow certain things down because you have the moment of reflecting at it while you're looking at it.
And I also note that teens find it's a very different thing sending a racy text with actual text versus a picture, which we'll get more into that in just a bit. We've got so many callers, though. Let's roll through a bunch of them. Rachel's calling from Woburn. Welcome to Radio Boston, Rachel.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling about my stepson. He's a wonderful boy. He was bound for college on a scholarship, full scholarship. And he had just turned 18, and he just came of age at the wrong time. It was new technology. This was a couple of years ago where this happened, but it was a new technology. There were no warnings. It was completely unknown territory, and a girl had sent him an unsolicited picture of herself nude, asked for one in return. His hands were tied. I mean, I feel like he must have felt like his hands were tied. So, otherwise, I don't know. So he sent it, a picture of himself, and he had just turned 18. She was a minor. Thousands of dollars later with courts, years in court, charged, convicted with possession of child porn. He's now a level 2 sex offender.
Huh.
And I feel like the laws have to change with the time, but it's so politically difficult because nobody wants to be seen as soft on crime, and that's how politics would work, I'm afraid.
Rachel, thank you much for calling and sharing your story. We'll get into the legal aspect of this in a second, but before we do, I want to take another call. Bobby is calling from Brookline. Bobby, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Well, first of all, I just wanted to say that I totally agree with the previous caller. I think the laws absolutely need to be changed. A 14-year-old being prosecuted for having a naked picture of another 14-year-old, especially if they're their girlfriend, is absurd. But I also wanted to say that I feel like every generation, like older generation, sees the younger generation as being more sexualized than they were,
mm-hmm.
and just forget about the fact that we all, like, I'm 20, and it wasn't so long ago that I was 14, and I remember this, and like, first it was television that was sexualizing the kids, and now it's cell phones and...
Bobby, I got to ask you, though. I mean, when there are shows like Skins out there whose advertising campaign is a pile of teenage-looking bodies naked on top of each other, that, to me, sounds like it's a little different than, you know, even 10, 20 years ago. I mean, and that's the norm.
But it's only more visible, like... Teens have been having sex since the dawn of time, and really what age you have sex isn't necessarily the most primary factor in whether or not it's a bad decision. You know, I know plenty of people who didn't have sex until they were, you know, my age,
mm-hmm.
and it was a terrible decision, and I know plenty of people who had sex when they were 14 and had perfectly happy relationships.
So you don't think technology or media has changed any of that. Bobby, thank you so much for your call. Alana writes on Facebook that phone companies could offer plans for teenagers that don't allow photo sharing or phones without cameras. That would allow parents at least some control. Interesting idea, Alana. I'm not quite sure how realistic that would be in this marketplace, but let's get one more call in here. Jolie is calling from Jamaica Plain. You're on the air, Jolie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to call in. I really agree with the caller who said that, you know, people have been having sex for a long, long time, and that people, you know, generationally, we talk about how people get more sexualized, kind of with more media and technology and all that. And what really frustrated me about the case that you described at the beginning of this segment from Washington State is that law enforcement got involved. Mm-hmm. I think that the last thing that these young people need at this point is to be criminalized, and really what they need is healthy adult support as they sort of make these difficult decisions about sexuality and about their lives and flirtation and all these different things. They don't need to be in contact with the law.
Jolie, let's pick up that point by bringing in another voice in this conversation, Dr. Michael Rich. He is an associate professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. He's the director of the Center on Media and Child Health at Boston Children's Hospital, and he also calls himself a mediatrician. Dr. Rich, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you've been listening to these callers, and you've listening to Dana Boyd about this issue of sexting. Jolie brought up this interesting point about, you know, supporting parents and helping them figure out what to do before bringing in law enforcement. How do you talk to parents who bring this issue to you when they visit your office?
Interestingly, many times parents come to me with the issue before it's an issue, with the question of, my kid wants a cell phone, what should I think about, how should we deal with this? I think the caller who suggested that the legal system is the wrong way to deal with this is right on the mark, in the sense that the law is a blunt instrument, as evidenced by the fact that they're calling these Class 2 felonies, or these kids are Class 2 sex offenders, and these are Class C felonies. I see sexting, for example, if you look at it from a developmental and scientific standpoint, as in some ways a perfect storm. You've got kids who are at the peak of their sexual urges, but also in many ways at the peak of their sexual naivete. They are incredibly facile with these media tools, which are not inherently malignant or helpful. They are just very powerful and different tools. They are surrounded by adults who are, and evidence shows this time and again, are clueless about two things. One is the media tools and how they work, but also, in many ways, clueless about their kids' sexuality. Most parents are completely unaware of when their kids start becoming sexually aware and sexually active.
Right. So I'm sorry to interrupt.
Finally, you've got, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
The final piece of this is that the law treats these kids as if they are adults, using laws that were designed to protect them against them. And what we know from neurodevelopment is these kids are not even going to have full executive functions in their brain until their mid to late 20s. So they are 10 years off from being able to have impulse control, future thinking, what we used to call the superego. So they don't really anticipate the consequences when they spontaneously send off that nude picture.
Let me turn back to Dana Boyd, but before I do, I noticed that one of our listeners has brought up the point that we initially said that 4% of students say that they're engaged in doing this, but I presume it's a much larger percentage who have received sex or sent ones that maybe aren't fully nude.
Correct. And it happens in every school. So, and it's also not even just receiving it, but seeing it on somebody else's phone. It starts to pervade the entire community.
So, Dana, what really, I mean, the question that Anthony and I were batting about at the beginning, what should parents do about this? I mean, if law enforcement, we don't want law enforcement to get involved. I mean, you can't necessarily take the phone away from a teen.
Right. I mean, there's a couple of different things. One is actually, we should be talking about reworking the laws, right? And that's actually one of the things where parents should be very much putting pressure on their representatives to really think through this. The child pornography laws are set up for very good reasons. They're meant to prosecute people who take pictures of a crime scene. And a rape against a child is a crime scene. And we don't want those photos anywhere on the internet. We want them gone, and we want to prosecute people to the full extent of the law. The people who had designed these laws never imagined that, you know, we would be prosecuting 16-year-olds who were just taking self-images. No one understood that that was where the technology would go. Of course, we want to leave room for 16-year-olds who rape smaller children as well. So it's not so clean as just saying room for prosecution. So part of it is that we should be really rethinking the laws. And, you know, the caller Rachel is totally right. These really need to be reworked, and there's serious consequences. We also need to really think about our own local communities with regard to the laws. Most of the time, what happens is that a local rogue prosecutor has decided that they want to be a vigilante, and they want to sort of teach those young kids a lesson. Mm-hmm. And that's what ends up happening around this, which is a dreadful approach. And at the same time, the schools actually have their hands tied, because in many ways, often they're required to report these things. So part of it is a form of media education, right? Talking to young people about what's going on, about all of the implications about this, why the consequences of this are different than the consequences for adults. And while we're reworking those laws, but be prepared for young people to realize and understand this. This isn't just about curbing their sexuality or curbing their sexual exploration, that they're playing a form of Russian roulette. And that Russian roulette may turn out to just be, you know, a lightweight slap on the wrist, or it may turn out to have serious long-term lifelong implications.
That is a tough thing to communicate to teens. Dr. Rich, I'm going to give you the last word here, because I guess my question is, in the age of technology, as Dana Boyd has described it, where things move faster and are amplified more quickly, and, you know, parents may or may not be as technologically adept as the teens that they're trying to, you know, help guide through this phase. Really, I mean, how do you recommend that they do essentially talk to children about this age-old issue of sexuality?
Well, I think it's a bigger question than that, which is that what we find time and again is that many parents, whether they are clueless or not, often check out of parenting in the realm of their kids' media use, whether it's watching TV or their internet use or their cell phones. And the big picture is your child is still developing. Your child is going to have these sexual urges and desires and is going to act on them because they don't have the brain development to see the future and to understand what the implications might be. So you need to parent them in this realm.
Dana Boyd?
Because you are the person who buys the phone, who buys the data plan, you need to set out the rules, you need to hold to the rules, and there need to be consequences, just like you would sit in the front seat of the car when you're teaching your child to drive.
Make them put on the seatbelt, but the cell phone style. Yeah.
Just make sure that
absolutely.
We don't...
Absolutely, and they will make mistakes, but this is part of the learning process, and you need to balance that freedom and the responsibility, but you need to be engaged and involved in this part of your child's life.
I think one key thing to not forget, though, is that it's not just the technology. What we're dealing with are age-old problems, age-old sexuality issues, age-old conversations. The technology changes it, but if we just focus on the technology, we miss the broader picture.
That's Dana Boyd. Exactly. She is a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Dana Boyd, such a pleasure to have you. Thank you for coming. And Dr. Michael Rich, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Harvard Medical School and Director of the Center on Media and Child Health at Children's Hospital. Thank you so much for joining us today as well.
Thank you.
Meghna, great conversation. And speaking of teenagers, technology, and their cell phones, students and teachers at the Broad Meadows Middle School in Quincy are in the midst of a 24-hour-long technology fast. That means Facebook, cell phones, texting, computers, and TV are totally off limits.
Oh, I can imagine how much they're suffering. But this isn't necessarily because of sexting or concerns of that nature.
No, in fact, they're doing it as part of a fundraiser and to raise awareness about global child poverty. The idea being, imagine what it's like for people in much of the world who live without this kind of technology, not to mention without basic food and shelter.
But we thought it would be interesting to hear how these middle schoolers are getting along without their cell phones. So we sent Radio Boston's Amory Sivertson down to Quincy to hear from them. The first voice you'll hear is their advisor, teacher Ron Adams.
At our open house way back in September, our principal stood up in front of all the parents at open house, and there were a lot of parents there. And the principal said, I wish I could stand here and tell you that many good things have happened at the school because of Facebook. But I can honestly say to you that we've never had one good thing happen at this school which was a direct result of Facebook.
My peers, they are always on their phone and they're always on Facebook.
There's just so many people using their cell phones all the time that it's almost constant. It's just like, oh, I'll send her a text instead of I'll call her, or I'll actually go and talk to her face to face.
When I'm with my friend, he, like, always has his phone out. Call him a textaholic when he isn't on technology, and I try talking to him. He still doesn't listen because he's waiting for someone to, like, text him.
I never turn off my phone because if I get a text message, I want to read it. It doesn't matter what time in the morning I get it, I always, like, look at it.
I'll be talking to one of my friends, and her phone will go off, and she'll, like, completely block me out and start texting someone and, like, answering the phone. And I'll be like, hi, I'm right here.
At first, it was really hard. I couldn't, like, I just wanted to watch TV,
But then after a while, like, you get used to it, and then you start thinking about, like, other kids in other countries that don't have, like, even the necessities of food.
I want my phone back because I text a lot of people, and I got used to it, like, really fast. And now that I don't have it, it's, like, it's bothering me a lot.
What a cool experiment, even if they do want their phones back at the end of the 24 hours. Those are students from the Broad Meadows Middle School in Quincy. They're participating in a 24-hour-long technology fast. We heard from Crystal LaForest, Pramila Murray, Kate Stevenson, Shania Donovan, Angela Hardy, and Tyler Grucci. We also heard from their advisor, Ron Adams.
And coming up after a quick break, we'll hear about the return of house calls in Boston's healthcare community. But first, WBUR is trying to raise all the money we need to run the station through the summer, all that money in the next 4 days. If we can do it, we'll cancel our June fundraiser. This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And here's producer Doug Tribou, reporter Monica Brady-Meyerov, and All Things Considered host Sasha Pfeiffer to tell you more.